a problem when your partner is getting the message that you're disgusted with him or her. Inevitably, contempt leads to more conflict rather than to reconciliation. Peter, the manager of a shoe store, was a master at contempt, at least when it came to his wife. Look what happens when he and Cynthia try to discuss their disparate views about spending money. He says, "Just look at the difference in our vehicles and our clothes. I think that says a lot for who we are and what we value. I mean, you tease me about washing my truck, and you go and pay to have somebody wash your car. We're paying through the nose for your car, and you can't be bothered to wash it. I think that's outrageous. I think that's probably the most spoiled thing that you do." This is a textbook example of contempt. He's not merely pointing out that they spend their money differently. He is accusing his wife of a moral deficiency, of being spoiled. Cynthia responds by telling him it's physically difficult for her to wash her car herself. Peter dismisses this explanation and continues to take the high moral ground. "I take care of my truck because if you take care of it, it'll last longer. I don't come from the mentality of, just go out and buy a new one that you seem to." Still hoping to get Peter on her side, Cynthia says, "If you could help me to wash my car, I'd really love that. I'd really appreciate it." But instead of grabbing this chance at reconciliation, Peter wants to do battle. "How many times have you helped me wash my truck?" he counters. Cynthia tries again to reconcile. "I will help you wash your truck if you'll help me wash my car." But Peter's goal is not to resolve this issue, but to dress her down. So he says, "That's not my question. How many times have you helped me?"
"Never," says Cynthia.
"See," says Peter, "that's where I think you have a little responsibility, too. It's like, you know, if your dad bought you a house, would you expect him to come over and paint it for you, too?"
"Well, will you always help me wash my car if I always help you wash your truck?"
"I'm not sure that I'd want you to help me," Peter says, laughing.
"Well, will you always help me wash my car, then?" Cynthia asks.
"I will help you when I can. I won't give you a blanket guarantee for life. What are you going to do, sue me?" asks Peter. And he laughs again. Listening to this discussion, it becomes clear that Peter's main purpose is to demean his wife. His contempt comes in the guise of assuming the high moral ground. As when he says, "I think that says a lot for who we are and what we value." Or, "I don't come from the mentality of just go out and buy a new one." Couples who are contemptuous of each other are more likely to suffer from infectious illnesses, colds, flu, and so on, than other people. Contempt is fueled by long-simmering negative thoughts about the partner. You're more likely to have such thoughts if your differences are not resolved. No doubt, the first time Peter and Cynthia argued about money, he wasn't so disrespectful. He probably offered a simple complaint like, "I think you should wash your own car. It costs too much to always have someone else wash it." But as they kept disagreeing about this, his complaints turned to global criticisms, such as, "You always spend too much money." And when the conflict continued, he felt more and more disgusted and fed up with Cynthia, a change that affected what he said when they argued. Belligerence, a close cousin to contempt, is just as deadly to a relationship. It is a form of aggressive anger because it contains a threat or provocation. When a wife complains that her husband doesn't come home from work in time for dinner, a belligerent response would be, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" When Peter says to Cynthia, "What are you going to do now, sue me?" he thinks he's making a joke, but he's really being belligerent. Horseman number 3, defensiveness. It's no surprise, considering how nasty her husband is being, that Cynthia defends herself. She points out that she doesn't get her car washed as often as he thinks. She explains that it's more difficult physically for her to wash her car herself than it is for him to wash his truck. Although it's understandable that Cynthia would defend herself, research shows that this approach rarely has the desired effect. The attacking spouse does not back down or apologize. This is because defensiveness is really a way of blaming your partner. You're saying, in effect, "The problem isn't me, it's you." Defensiveness just escalates the conflict, which is why it's so deadly. When Cynthia tells Peter how hard it is for her to wash her car, he doesn't say, "Oh, now I understand." He ignores her excuse. He doesn't even acknowledge what she said. He climbs farther up his high moral ground, telling her how well he takes care of his vehicle and implying that she's spoiled for not doing the same. Cynthia can't win, and neither can their marriage. Criticism, contempt, and defensiveness don't always gallop into a home in strict order. They function more like a relay match, handing the baton off to each other over and over again if the couple can't put a stop to it. You can see this happening as Oliver and Dara continue their discussion about cleaning their house. Although they seem to be seeking a solution, Dara becomes increasingly contemptuous, mocking Oliver in the guise of questioning him and tearing down every plan he devises. The more defensive he becomes, the more she attacks him. Her body language signals condescension. She speaks softly, her elbows resting on the table, her intertwined fingers cradling her chin. Like a law professor or a judge, she peppers him with questions just to see him squirm. Dara. So you think that's the cure-all, to give you 15 minutes? Sneering. Oliver. No, I don't think that's the cure-all. I think, combined with writing up a list of weekly tasks that have to get done, why not put it on a calendar? Hey, I'll see it right then and there. Dara. Just like when I write stuff in your daytimer, it gets done. Mocking him, more contempt. Oliver. I don't always have a chance to look at my daytimer during the day. Defensive. Dara. So you think you'll look at a calendar then? Oliver. Yeah. At any point in time, if I'm not up to speed, you should ask me about it. But when that happens now, it's not you asking, it's you telling me you haven't done this and you haven't done that. Instead, say, is there any reason why you haven't done this or that? Like, I mean, when I stayed up and did your resume that one night. Stuff like that happens all the time, and you just don't take that into account at all. Defensive. Dara. And I don't just all of a sudden do things for you either? Defensive. Oliver. No, you do. I think you need to relax a little bit. Dara. Sarcastic. Well, that sounds like we solved a lot. Obviously, Dara and Oliver have resolved nothing, thanks to the prevalence of criticism, contempt, and defensiveness. Horseman number 4, stonewalling. In marriages like Dara and Oliver's, where discussions begin with a harsh setup, where criticism and contempt lead to defensiveness, which leads to more contempt and more defensiveness, eventually, one partner tunes out. This heralds the arrival of the fourth horseman. Think of the husband who comes home from work, gets met with a barrage of criticism from his wife, and hides behind the newspaper. The less responsive he is, the more she yells. Eventually, he gets up and leaves the room. Rather than confronting his wife, he disengages. By turning away from her, he is avoiding a fight, but he is also avoiding his marriage. He has become a stonewaller. Although both husbands and wives can be stonewallers, this behavior is far more common among men for reasons we'll see later. During a typical conversation between two people, the listener gives all kinds of cues to the speaker that he's paying attention. He may use eye contact, nod his head, say something like, yeah, or uh-huh. But a stonewaller doesn't give you this sort of casual feedback. He tends to look away or down without uttering a sound. He sits like an impassive stone wall. The stonewaller acts as though he couldn't care less about what you're saying, if he even hears it. Stonewalling usually arrives later in the course of a marriage than the other three horsemen. That's why it's less common among newlywed husbands such as Oliver than among couples who have been in a negative spiral for a while. It takes time for the negativity created by the first three horsemen to become overwhelming enough that stonewalling becomes an understandable out. That's the stance that Mac takes when he and his wife, Rita, argue about each other's behavior at parties. She says the problem is that he drinks too much. He thinks the bigger problem is her reaction. She embarrasses him by yelling at him in front of his friends. Here they are, already in the middle of an argument. Rita, now I've become the problem again. I started off with a complaint, but now I am the problem. That always seems to happen. Mac, yeah, I do that, I know. Pause. But your tantrums and childishness are an embarrassment to me and my friends. Rita. If you would control your drinking at parties, please. Mac. looks down, avoids eye contact, says nothing. He's stonewalling. Rita,
because I think, for the most part, we get along pretty well, really.
Laughs. Mac, continues to stonewall, remains silent, makes no eye contact, head nods, facial movements, or vocalizations. Rita,
don't you think?
Mac, no response. Rita,
Mac? Hello?
The third sign, flooding. It may seem to Rita that her complaints have no effect on Mac, but nothing could be further from the truth. Usually people stonewall as a protection against feeling flooded. Flooding means that your spouse's negativity, whether in the guise of criticism or contempt or even defensiveness, is so overwhelming and so sudden that it leaves you shell-shocked. You feel so defenseless against this sniper attack that you learn to do anything to avoid a replay. The more often you feel flooded by your spouse's criticism or contempt, the more hypervigilant you are for cues that your spouse is about to blow again. All you can think about is protecting yourself from the turbulence your spouse's onslaught causes. And the way to do that is to disengage emotionally from the relationship. No wonder Mac and Rita are now divorced. Another husband, Paul, was quite upfront about why he stonewalls when his wife Amy gets negative. In the following discussion, he articulates what all stonewallers are feeling. Amy,
when I get mad, that's when you should step in and try to make it better. But when you just stop talking, it means, I no longer care how you feel. That just makes me feel 1 inch tall, like my opinion or feelings have absolutely no bearing on you. And that's not the way a marriage should be.
Paul, what I'm saying is, if you want to have a serious conversation, you're going to do it without yelling and screaming all the time. You start saying things that are hurtful. Amy,
well, when I'm hurt, mad, and I want to hurt you, I start saying things. And that's when we should both stop. I should say I'm sorry, and you should say, I know that you want to talk about this, and I really should make an effort to talk instead of just ignoring you.
Paul,
I'll talk when...
Amy, it fits your purpose.
Paul,
no, when you're not yelling and screaming and jumping up and down, stomping. Amy kept telling Paul how it made her feel when he shut down. But she did not seem to hear him tell her why he shuts down. He can't handle her hostility. This couple later divorced. A marriage's meltdown can be predicted then by habitual harsh startup and frequent flooding brought on by the relentless presence of the four horsemen during disagreements. Although each of these factors alone can predict a divorce, they usually coexist in an unhappy marriage. The fourth sign, body language. Even if I could not hear the conversation between Mac the Stonewaller and his wife Rita, I would be able to predict their divorce simply by looking at his physiological readings. When we monitor couples for bodily changes during a tense discussion, we can see just how physically distressing flooding is. One of the most apparent of these physical reactions is that the heart speeds up, pounding away at more than 100 beats per minute, even as high as 165. In contrast, a typical heart rate for a man who is about 30 is 76, and for a woman the same age, 82. Hormonal changes occur too, including the secretion of adrenaline, which kicks in the fight-or-flight response. Blood pressure also mounts. These changes are so dramatic that if one partner is frequently flooded during marital discussions, it's easy to predict that they will divorce. Recurring episodes of flooding lead to divorce for two reasons. First, they signal that at least one partner feels severe emotional distress when dealing with the other. Second, the physical sensations of feeling flooded, the increased heart rate, sweating, and so on, make it virtually impossible to have a productive, problem-solving discussion. When your body goes into overdrive during an argument, it is responding to a very primitive alarm system we inherited from our prehistoric ancestors. All those distressful reactions, like a pounding heart and sweating, occur because on a fundamental level, your body perceives your current situation as dangerous. Even though we live in the age of in vitro conception, organ transplants, and gene mapping, from an evolutionary standpoint, Not much time has passed since we were cave dwellers. So the human body has not refined its fear reactions. It responds the same way whether you're facing a saber-toothed tiger or a contemptuous spouse demanding to know why you can never remember to put the toilet seat back down. When a pounding heart and all the other physical stress reactions happen in the midst of a discussion with your mate, the consequences are disastrous. Your ability to process information is reduced, meaning it's harder to pay attention to what your partner is saying. Creative problem-solving goes out the window. You're left with the most reflexive, least intellectually sophisticated responses in your repertoire. To fight, act critical, contemptuous, or defensive, or flee. Stonewall. Any chance of resolving the issue is gone. Most likely, the discussion will just worsen the situation. Men and women really are different. In 85% of marriages, the stonewaller is the husband. This is not because of some lack on the man's part. The reason lies in our evolutionary heritage. Anthropological evidence suggests that we evolved from hominids whose lives were circumscribed by very rigid gender roles, since these were advantageous to survival in a harsh environment. The female specialized in nurturing children, while the male specialized in cooperative hunting. As any nursing mother can tell you, the amount of milk you produce is affected by how relaxed you feel, which is related to the release of the hormone oxytocin in the brain. So natural selection would favor a female who could quickly soothe herself and calm down after feeling stressed. Her ability to remain composed could enhance her children's chances of survival by optimizing the amount of nutrition they received. But in the male, natural selection would reward the opposite response. For these early cooperative hunters, maintaining vigilance was a key survival skill. So males whose adrenaline kicked in quite readily and who did not calm down so easily were more likely to survive and procreate. To this day, the male cardiovascular system remains more reactive than the female and slower to recover from stress. For example, if a man and woman suddenly hear a very loud, brief sound, like a blowout, most likely his heart will beat faster than hers and stay accelerated for longer, according to research by Robert Levinson, Ph.D., and his student Lauren Carter at the University of California at Berkeley. The same goes for their blood pressure. His will become more elevated and stay higher longer. Psychologist Dolph Zillman, Ph.D., at the University of Alabama, has found that when male subjects are deliberately treated rudely and then told to relax for 20 minutes, their blood pressure surges and stays elevated until they get to retaliate. But when women face the same treatment, they are able to calm down during those 20 minutes. Interestingly, a woman's blood pressure tends to rise again if she is pressured into retaliating. Since marital confrontation that activates vigilance takes a greater physical toll on the male, it's no surprise that men are more likely than women to attempt to avoid it. It's a biological fact. Men are more easily overwhelmed by marital conflict than are their wives. This gender difference in how physiologically reactive our bodies are also influences what men and women tend to think about when they experience marital stress. As part of some experiments, we ask couples to watch themselves arguing on tape and then tell us what they were thinking when our sensors detected they were flooded. Their answers suggest that men have a greater tendency to have negative thoughts that maintain their distress, while women are more likely to think soothing thoughts that help them calm down and be conciliatory. Men, generally, think about how righteous and indignant they feel. I'm gonna get even. I don't have to take this, which tends to lead to contempt or belligerence. Or they think about themselves as an innocent victim of their wife's wrath or complaint. Why is she always blaming me? Which leads to defensiveness. Obviously, these rules don't hold for every male and every female. But after 25 years of research, I have noted that the majority of couples do follow these gender differences in physiological and psychological reactions to stress. Because of these dissimilarities, most marriages, including healthy, happy ones, follow a comparable pattern of conflict in which the wife, who is constitutionally better able to handle the stress, brings up sensitive issues. The husband, who is not as able to cope with it, will attempt to avoid getting into the subject. He may become defensive and stonewall. Or he may even become belligerent or contemptuous in an attempt to silence her. Just because your marriage follows this pattern, it's not a given that a divorce is in the offing. In fact, you'll find examples of all four horsemen and even occasional flooding in stable marriages. But when the four horsemen take up permanent residence, when either partner begins to feel flooded routinely, the relationship is in serious trouble. Frequently feeling flooded leads almost inevitably to distancing yourself from your spouse. That in turn leads you to feel lonely. Without help, the couple will end up divorced or living in a dead marriage, in which they maintain separate, parallel lives in the same home. They may go through the motions of togetherness, attending their children's plays, hosting dinner parties, taking family vacations, but emotionally, they no longer feel connected to each other. They have given up. The fifth sign, failed repair attempts. It takes time for the four horsemen and the flooding that comes in their wake to overrun a marriage. And yet, divorce can so often be predicted by listening to a single conversation between newlyweds. How can this be? The answer is that by analyzing any disagreement a couple has, you get a good sense of the pattern they tend to follow. A crucial part of that pattern is whether their repair attempts succeed or fail. Repair attempts, as I described earlier, are efforts the couple makes, let's take a break, wait, I need to calm down, to de-escalate the tension during a touchy discussion, to put on the brakes so flooding is prevented. Repair attempts save marriages not just because they decrease emotional tension between spouses, but because by lowering the stress level, they also prevent your heart from racing and making you feel flooded. When the four horsemen rule a couple's communication, repair attempts often don't even get noticed. Especially when you're feeling flooded, you're not able to hear a verbal white flag. In unhappy marriages, a feedback loop develops between the four horsemen and the failure of repair attempts. The more contemptuous and defensive the couple is with each other, the more flooding occurs, and the harder it is to hear and respond to a repair. And since the repair is not heard, the contempt and defensiveness just get heightened, making flooding more pronounced, which makes it more difficult to hear the next repair attempt. Until finally, one partner withdraws. That's why I can predict a divorce by hearing only one discussion between a husband and wife. The failure of repair attempts is an accurate marker for an unhappy future. The presence of the four horsemen alone predicts divorce with only an 82% accuracy. But when you add in the failure of repair attempts, the accuracy rate reaches into the 90s. This is because some couples who trot out the four horsemen when they argue are also successful at repairing the harm the horsemen cause. Usually in this situation, when the four horsemen are present, but the couple's repair attempts are successful, the result is a stable, happy marriage. In fact, 84% of the newlyweds who were high on the four horsemen but repaired effectively were in stable, happy marriages 6 years later. But if there are no repair attempts, or if the attempts are not able to be heard, the marriage is in serious danger. I can tell 96% of the time whether a marital discussion will resolve a conflict after the first 3 minutes of that discussion. In emotionally intelligent marriages, I hear a wide range of successful repair attempts. Each person has his or her own approach. Olivia and Nathaniel stick out their tongues. Other couples laugh or smile or say they're sorry. Even an irritated, "Hey, stop yelling at me," or "You're getting off the topic," can diffuse a tense situation. All such repair attempts keep a marriage stable because they prevent the four horsemen from moving in for good. Whether a repair succeeds or fails has very little to do with how eloquent it is and everything to do with the state of the marriage. One happily married couple who taught me this lesson were Hal and Jody. Because of the nature of his research, Hal, a chemist, would often find out at the last minute that he wouldn't be able to get home for dinner. Although Jody knew Hal couldn't control his hours, the dinner situation frustrated her. When they discussed the problem in our lab, she pointed out to him that the kids always refused to eat dinner till he got home, so they were often having their dinner very late, which she didn't like. So Hal suggested that she give them a snack to tide them over. Incredulous, Jody snapped at him. "What do you think I've been doing all along?"
Hal realized that he had screwed up. He had displayed a significant lack of awareness about what went on in his own home, and worse, had insulted his wife's intelligence. In an unhappy marriage, this could easily be the grounds for some major league sniping. I waited to see what would happen next. Since all other evidence suggested they were happily married, I anticipated that Hal would use some very skillfully wrought repair attempt. But Hal just gave Jody a really goofy smile. Jody burst out laughing, and they went on with their discussion. Hal's quick grin worked, because their marriage was working. But when Oliver tried to soften up Dara by chuckling during their conversation about housekeeping, he got nowhere. In marriages in which the four horsemen have moved in for good, even the most articulate, sensitive, well-targeted repair attempt is likely to fail abysmally. Ironically, we see more repair attempts between troubled couples than between those whose marriages are going smoothly. The more repair attempts fail, the more these couples keep trying. It can be poignant to hear one member of a couple offer up one repair attempt after another, all to no avail. What makes the difference? What predicts that repair attempts will work? Later, we'll see that it is the quality of the friendship between husband and wife. And as I described in Chapter 1, positive sentiment override. The sixth sign, bad memories. When a relationship gets subsumed in negativity, it's not only the couple's present and future life together that are put at risk. Their past is in danger, too. When I interview couples, I usually ask about the history of their marriage. I have found over and over that couples who are deeply entrenched in a negative view of their spouse and their marriage often rewrite their past. When I ask them about their early courtship, their wedding, their first year together, I can predict their chances of divorce, even if I'm not privy to their current feelings. Most couples enter marriage with high hopes and great expectations. In a happy marriage, couples tend to look back on their early days fondly. Even if the wedding didn't go off perfectly, they tend to remember the highlights rather than the low points. The same goes for each other. They remember how positive they felt early on, how excited they were when they met, and how much admiration they had for each other. When they talk about the tough times they've had, they glorify the struggles they've been through, drawing strength from the adversity they weathered together. But when a marriage is not going well, history gets rewritten for the worse. Now she recalls that he was 30 minutes late getting to the ceremony. Or he focuses on all that time she spent talking to his best man at the rehearsal dinner, or flirting with his friend as it seems to him now. Another sad sign is when you find the past difficult to remember. It has become so unimportant or painful that you've let it fade away. Peter and Cynthia didn't always spend their days arguing about car washing and other money matters. No doubt, if you looked at their photo album, you would find plenty of happy pictures from their early days together. But those pictures have long faded from their minds. When asked to describe the early days, they do a good job of telling the facts of their courtship and marriage, but nothing more. Cynthia recounts that they met at a record store where she was the cashier. She got his name and number from his charge card receipt and called him up to see if he liked the CDs he had bought. Their first date followed. Cynthia says that she was attracted to Peter at first because he was going to college and was interesting to talk to and nice-looking. "I think it was the fact that I had a charge card," Peter slips in, a snide reference to their current fights over money. He himself seems to have a hard time remembering what attracted him to her when they first met. He says, long pause. "I honestly don't know. I never tried to pin it down to one thing. I think for me, that would be pretty dangerous." When they're asked about the kinds of activities they enjoyed back then, they have a hard time remembering. "Didn't we go on picnics or something?" Cynthia asks him, and he shrugs. The same blank feeling is there when they discuss their decision to marry. "I thought it would solidify the relationship. It seemed like a logical progression. That's basically the main reason," says Peter. He recalls that he proposed to her at a restaurant by tying the ring to a white ribbon wrapped around a bunch of white roses. That sounds promising, until he adds with a sad chuckle, "I'll never forget this. She saw the ring. She started shaking a little bit, and she looked, and she asked me, I suppose you want an answer. That's kind of not the reaction I was looking for. He turns to his wife. You weren't smiling or laughing or anything when you said it. You were just deadpan. Like, you idiot. Oh, no, Cynthia says limply. The picture doesn't get any better. Peter had pneumonia and a temperature of 103 at their wedding. His main memory, other than feeling sick, was being in the limo afterward with Cynthia and his best man. His friend turned on the stereo, and the Motley Crue song, Same Old Ball and Chain, came blasting out. Cynthia remembers feeling hurt because many guests left right after dinner. Peter recalls that everyone kept banging on their glasses with spoons to make him and Cynthia kiss. I was getting really annoyed, he recalls. To sum up their wedding day, he says, It was your basic tragedy. Cynthia smiles wanly in agreement. The reason Peter and Cynthia have such distorted memories is that the negativity between them has become so intense, it's as if it's cast in stone. When the four horsemen overrun a home, impairing the communication, the negativity mushrooms to such a degree that everything a spouse does, or ever did, is recast in a negative light. In a happy marriage, if the husband promises to pick up the wife's dry cleaning but forgets, she is likely to think, Oh, well, he's been under a lot of stress lately and needs more sleep. She considers his lapse to be fleeting and caused by a specific situation. In an unhappy marriage, the same circumstance is likely to lead to a thought like, He's just always so inconsiderate and selfish. By the same token, in a happy marriage, a loving gesture, like a wife greeting her husband with a passionate kiss at the end of the workday, is seen as a sign that the spouse is loving and considerate. But in an unhappy marriage, the same action will lead the husband to think, What does she want out of me? This distorted perception explains why one husband we studied, Mitch, saw ulterior motives whenever his wife Leslie bought him a gift, hugged him, or even called him on the phone. Over time, he had rewritten his view of their marriage, creating a very negative script. Whenever a conflict arose, he was all set to feel self-righteous and indignant. His negative thoughts about Leslie helped maintain his distress. He'd get flooded as soon as they had a confrontation. Negative expectations of her and their relationship became the norm. Eventually, they divorced. The end draws near. When a marriage gets to the point where the couple have rewritten their history, when their minds and bodies make it virtually impossible to communicate and repair their current problems, it is almost bound to fail. They find themselves constantly on red alert. Because they always expect to do combat, the marriage becomes a torment. The understandable result, they withdraw from the relationship. Sometimes a couple at this end stage of marriage will come for counseling. On the surface, it may seem like nothing much is wrong. They don't argue or act contemptuous or stonewall. They don't do much of anything. They talk calmly and distantly about their relationship and their conflicts. An inexperienced therapist could easily assume that their problems don't run very deep. But actually, one or both of them has already disengaged emotionally from the marriage. Some people leave a marriage literally by divorcing. Others do so by leading parallel lives together. Whichever the route, there are four final stages that signal the death knell of a relationship. 1. You see your marital problems as severe. 2. Talking things over seems useless. You try to solve problems on your own. 3. You start leading parallel lives. 4. Loneliness sets in. When a couple gets to the last stage, one or both partners may have an affair. But an affair is usually a symptom of a dying marriage, not the cause. The end of that marriage could have been predicted long before either spouse strayed. Too often, couples begin to seek help for their marriage after they've already hit troubled waters. The warning signs were almost always there early on if they had known what to look for. You can see the seeds of trouble in 1. What couples actually say to each other, the prevalence of harsh startup, the four horsemen, and the unwillingness to accept influence, 2. The failure of their repair attempts, 3. Physiological reactions, flooding, or 4. Pervasive negative thoughts about their marriage.
Any of these signs suggest that emotional separation, and in most cases divorce, may only be a matter of time. But it's not over till it's over. As bleak as this sounds, I'm convinced that far more marriages could be saved than currently are. Even a marriage that is about to hit bottom can be revived with the right kind of help. Sadly, most marriages at this stage get the wrong kind. Well-meaning therapists will deluge the couple with advice about negotiating their differences and improving their communication. At one time, I would have done the same. At first, when I figured out how to predict divorce, I thought I had found the key to saving marriages. All that was necessary, I presumed, was to teach people how to argue without being overridden by the four horsemen and without getting flooded. Then their repair attempts would succeed, and they could work out their differences. But like so many experts before me, I was wrong. I was not able to crack the code to saving marriages until I started to analyze what went right in happy marriages. After intensely studying happily married couples for as long as 16 years, I now know that the key to reviving or divorce-proofing a relationship is not in how you handle disagreements, but in how you are with each other when you're not fighting. So although my seven principles will also guide you in coping with conflict, the foundation of my approach is to strengthen the friendship that is at the heart of any marriage. 3. Principle 1. Enhance your love maps. Publisher's note. This chapter and those that follow contain several exercises. As you listen, it may be helpful to have a pen and paper available to participate in these exercises. Rory was a pediatrician who ran an intensive care unit for babies. He was beloved at the hospital, where everybody called him Dr. Rory. He was a reserved man, but capable of great warmth, humor, and charm. He was also a workaholic who slept in the hospital an average of 20 nights a month. He didn't know the names of his children's friends, or even the name of a family dog. When he was asked where the back door to the house was, he turned to ask his wife, Lisa. His wife was upset with how little she saw of Rory and how emotionally unconnected to her he seemed to be. She frequently tried to make little gestures to show him she cared, but her attempts just annoyed him. She was left with the sense that he simply didn't value her or their marriage. To this day, I'm struck by the story of this couple. Here was an intellectually gifted man who didn't even know the name of the family dog or how to find the back door. Of the many problems their relationship faced, perhaps the most fundamental was Rory's shocking lack of knowledge about his home life. He had become so caught up in his work that little space was left over in his brain for the basics of his wife's world. As bizarre as Rory's rampant ignorance may sound, I have found that many married couples fall into a similar, if less dramatic, habit of inattention to the details of their spouse's life. One or both partners may have only the sketchiest sense of the other's joys, likes, dislikes, fears, stresses. The husband may love modern art, but his wife couldn't tell you why or who his favorite artist is. He doesn't remember the names of her friends or the co-worker she fears is constantly trying to undermine her. In contrast, emotionally intelligent couples are intimately familiar with each other's world. I call this having a richly detailed love map, my term for that part of your brain where you store all the relevant information about your partner's life. Another way of saying this is that these couples have made plenty of cognitive room for their marriage. They remember the major events in each other's history, and they keep updating their information as the facts and feelings of their spouse's world change. When she orders him a salad, she knows to ask for his dressing on the side. If she works late, he'll tape her favorite TV show because he knows which one it is and when it's on. He could tell you how she's feeling about her boss and exactly how to get to her office from the elevator. He knows that religion is important to her, but that deep down she has doubts. She knows that he fears being too much like his father and considers himself a free spirit. They know each other's goals in life, each other's worries, each other's hopes. Without such a love map, you can't really know your spouse. And if you don't really know someone, how can you truly love them? No wonder the biblical term for sexual love is to know. In knowledge, there is strength. From knowledge springs not only love, but the fortitude to weather marital storms. Couples who have detailed love maps of each other's world are far better prepared to cope with stressful events and conflict. Take, for example, one of the major causes of marital dissatisfaction and divorce, the birth of the first baby. 67% of couples in our newlywed study underwent a precipitous drop in marital satisfaction the first time they became parents. But the remaining 33% did not experience this drop. In fact, about half of them saw their marriages improve. What separated these two groups? You guessed it. The couples whose marriages thrived after the birth had detailed love maps from the get-go, according to a study of 50 couples by my student Allison Shapiro. These love maps protected their marriages in the wake of this dramatic upheaval. Because husband and wife were already in the habit of keeping up to date and were intently aware of what each other was feeling and thinking, they weren't thrown off course. But if you don't start off with a deep knowledge of each other, it's easy for your marriage to lose its way when your lives shift so suddenly and dramatically. Maggie and Ken knew each other only a short time when they married and decided to have a family. But what their relationship lacked in longevity, they made up for in intimacy. They were in touch not just with the outlines of each other's lives, their favorite hobbies, sports, and so on, but with each other's deepest longings, beliefs, and fears. No matter how busy they were, they made each other their priority, always making sure they had time to catch up on each other's day. And at least once a week, they'd go out for dinner and just talk, sometimes about politics, sometimes about the weather, sometimes about their own marriage. When their daughter Alice was born, Maggie decided to give up her job as a computer scientist to stay home with the baby. She herself was surprised by the decision, since she had always been very driven in her career. But when she became a mother, her fundamental sense of meaning in life changed. She found she was willing to undergo great sacrifices for Alice's sake. Now she wanted the savings they had earmarked for a motorboat to go into a college fund. What happened to Maggie happens to many new mothers. The experience of parenthood is so profound that your whole notion of who you are and what you value gets reshuffled. At first, Ken was confused by the changes in his wife. The woman he thought he knew was transforming before his eyes. But because they were in the habit of staying deeply connected, Ken was able to keep up to date on what Maggie was thinking and feeling. Too often when a new baby comes, the husband gets left behind. More on this and ways of dealing with it in Chapter 9. He can't keep up with his wife's metamorphosis, which he may not understand or be happy about. Knowing Maggie had always been a priority to Ken, so he didn't do what many new fathers do. He didn't back away from this new charmed circle of mother and child. As a result, they went through the transformation to parenthood together, without losing sight of each other or their marriage. Having a baby is just one life event that can cause couples to lose their way without a detailed love map. Any major change, from a job shift to a move to illness or retirement, can have the same effect. Just the passage of time can do it as well. The more you know and understand about each other, the easier it is to keep connected as life swirls around you. Love Maps Questionnaire. By giving honest answers to the following questions, you will get a sense of the quality of your current love maps. For the most accurate reading of how your marriage is doing on this first principle, both of you should complete the following. Listen to each statement and mark down whether it's true or false. 1. I can name my partner's best friends. 2. I can tell you what stresses my partner is currently facing. 3. I know the names of some of the people who have been irritating my partner lately. 4. I can tell you some of my partner's life dreams. 5. I am very familiar with my partner's religious beliefs and ideas. 6. I can tell you about my partner's basic philosophy of life. 7. I can list the relatives my partner likes the least. 8. I know my partner's favorite music. 9. I can list my partner's 3 favorite movies. 10. My spouse is familiar with my current stresses. 11. I know the three most special times in my partner's life. 12. I can tell you the most stressful thing that happened to my partner as a child. 13. I can list my partner's major aspirations and hopes in life. 14. I know my partner's major current worries. 15. My spouse knows who my friends are. 16. I know what my partner would want to do if he or she suddenly won the lottery. 17. I can tell you in detail my first impressions of my partner. 18. Periodically, I ask my partner about his or her world right now. 19. I feel that my partner knows me pretty well. 20. My spouse is familiar with my hopes and aspirations. Scoring. Give yourself 1 point for each true answer. 10 or above, this is an area of strength for your marriage. You have a fairly detailed map of your spouse's everyday life, hopes, fears, and dreams. You know what makes your spouse tick. Based on your score, you'll probably find the love map exercises that follow easy and gratifying. They will serve as a reminder of how connected you and your partner are.
Try not to take for granted this knowledge and understanding of each other. Keeping in touch in this way ensures you'll be well-equipped to handle any problem areas that crop up in your relationship.
Below 10, your marriage could stand some improvement in this area. Perhaps you never had the time or the tools to really get to know each other. Or perhaps your love maps have become outdated as your lives have changed over the years. In either case, by taking the time to learn more about your spouse now, you'll find your relationship becomes stronger. There are few gifts a couple can give each other greater than the joy that comes from feeling known and understood. Getting to know each other shouldn't be a chore. That's why the first love map exercise is actually a game. While you're having fun playing, you'll also be expanding and deepening your knowledge of each other. By the time you complete all of the exercises in this chapter, you'll know there's truth in that old song, "To know you is to love you." Exercise 1, the Love Map 20 Questions Game. Play this game together in the spirit of laughter and gentle fun. The more you play, the more you'll learn about the Love Map's concept and how to apply it to your own relationship. Step 1. Each of you should take a piece of paper and pen or pencil. Together, randomly decide on 20 numbers between 1 and 60. Write the numbers down in a column on the left-hand side of your paper. Step 2. In a moment, you'll hear a list of numbered questions. Beginning with the top of your column, match the numbers you choose with the corresponding question. Each of you should ask your partner this question. If your spouse answers correctly, you be the judge. He or she receives the number of points indicated for that question, and you receive 1 point. If your spouse answers incorrectly, neither of you receives any points. The same rules apply when you answer. The winner is the person with the higher score after you both answered all 20 questions. 1. Name my two closest friends. 2 points. 2. What is my favorite musical group, composer, or instrument? 2 points. 3. What was I wearing when we first met? 2 points. 4. Name one of my hobbies. 3 points. 5. Where was I born? 1 point. 6. What stresses am I facing right now? 4 points. 7. Describe in detail what I did today or yesterday. 4 points. 8. When is my birthday? 1 point. 9. What is the date of our anniversary? 1 point. 10. Who is my favorite relative? 2 points. 11. What is my fondest unrealized dream? 5 points. 12. What is my favorite flower? 2 points. 13. What is one of my greatest fears or disaster scenarios? 3 points. 14. What is my favorite time of day for lovemaking? 3 points. 15. What makes me feel most competent? 4 points. 16. What turns me on sexually? 3 points. 17. What is my favorite meal? 2 points. 18. What is my favorite way to spend an evening? 2 points. 19. What is my favorite color? 1 point. 20. What personal improvements do I want to make in my life? 4 points. 21. What kind of present would I like best? 2 points. 22. What was one of my best childhood experiences? 2 points. 23. What was my favorite vacation? 2 points. 24. What is one of my favorite ways to be soothed? 4 points. 25. Who is my greatest source of support other than you? 3 points. 26. What is my favorite sport? 2 points. 27. What do I most like to do with time off? 2 points. 28. What is one of my favorite weekend activities? 2 points. 29. What is my favorite getaway place? 3 points. 30. What is my favorite movie? 2 points. 31. What are some of the important events coming up in my life? How do I feel about them? 4 points. 32. What are some of my favorite ways to work out? 2 points. 33. Who was my best friend in childhood? 3 points. 34. What is one of my favorite magazines? 2 points. 35. Name one of my major rivals or enemies. 3 points. 36. What would I consider my ideal job? 4 points. 37. What do I fear the most? 4 points. 38. Who is my least favorite relative? 3 points. 39. What is my favorite holiday? 2 points. 40. What kind of books do I most like to read? 3 points. 41. What is my favorite TV show? 2 points. 42. Which side of the bed do I prefer? 2 points. 43. What am I most sad about? 4 points. 44. Name one of my concerns or worries. 4 points. 45. What medical problems do I worry about? 2 points. 46. What was my most embarrassing moment? 3 points. 47. What was my worst childhood experience? 3 points. 48. Name two of the people I most admire. 4 points. 49. Name my major rival or enemy. 3 points. 50. Of all the people we both know, who do I like the least? 3 points. 51. What is one of my favorite desserts? 2 points. 52. What is my social security number? 2 points. 53. Name one of my favorite novels. 2 points. 54. What is my favorite restaurant? 2 points. 55. What are two of my aspirations, hopes, wishes? 4 points. 56. Do I have a secret ambition? What is it? 4 points. 57. What foods do I hate? 2 points. 58. What is my favorite animal? 2 points. 59. What is my favorite song? 2 points. 60. Which sports team is my favorite? 2 points. Play this game as frequently as you'd like. The more you play, the more you'll come to understand the concept of a love map and the kind of information yours should include about your spouse. Exercise 2. Make your own love maps. Now that you have a clearer understanding of the love maps concept, it's time to focus more seriously on your love maps for each other's everyday lives. Even though these maps are all in your head, it helps to write down some of the basics. Spend extra time on this exercise if you or your spouse believe that your current love map is inadequate, or, as is often the case, has fallen out of date. Use the following suggestions to interview each other as if you were reporters. If your spouse is unavailable, you can fill in this information without his or her input. But obviously, the major benefits of this exercise come from sharing. Take turns as listener and speaker and write out the answers to these questions. It's best to use a separate piece of paper, or better yet, a notebook or journal that you can use for all of the exercises in this book. Don't pass judgment on what your spouse tells you or try to give each other advice. Remember that you are simply on a fact-finding mission. Your goal is to listen and learn about your mate. The cast of characters in my partner's life. Friends. Potential friends. Rivals, competitors, enemies. Recent important events in my partner's life. Upcoming events. What is my partner looking forward to? Dreading. My partner's current stresses. My partner's current worries. My partner's hopes and aspirations. For self, for others. Although this exercise offers you just a snapshot of your partner's life, it can be quite illuminating. Couples who have completed our workshop say this exercise offered them plenty of surprises that helped them better understand their spouse. Joe, for example, never realized just how deeply Donna longed to be an author and how frustrated she was in her banking job until he asked her point blank about her hopes and aspirations. And she never realized that his recent irritability was rooted in his concern about his new boss and his job performance, not her mother's visit. This Love Maps form is useful for creating a broad outline of your current lives. But Love Maps shouldn't just be broad, they should also be deep. The next exercise will ensure that yours are. Exercise 3. Who am I? The more you know about each other's inner world, the more profound and rewarding your relationship will be. This questionnaire is designed both to guide you through some self-exploration and to help you share this exploration with your partner. Work on this exercise even if you and your spouse consider yourselves open books. There's always more to know about each other. Life changes us, so neither of you may be the same person who spoke those wedding vows 5, 10, or 50 years ago. Many of the questions in this exercise are powerful. Please make sure you have enough time and privacy to do them justice. In fact, it may be best to reserve this exercise for an uninterrupted stretch when you do not have work to do, deadlines to meet, phone calls to answer, or children or anybody else to look after. Most likely, you won't be able to complete this questionnaire in one sitting, nor should you try. Instead, break it up by section and do it slowly over time together. Answer the questions in each section as candidly as you can. You don't have to answer every aspect of each question. Just respond to the parts that are relevant to your life. Write your answers in your private journal or notebook. If writing so much is hard, you can do it in outline form. But the process of writing this down is important to the success of the exercise. When you're ready, exchange notebooks and share with each other what you have written. Discuss each other's entries and what this added knowledge implies for your marriage and the deepening of your friendship. My triumphs and strivings. 1. What has happened in your life that you are particularly proud of? Write about your psychological triumphs. Times when things went even better than you expected. Periods when you came through trials and tribulations even better off. Include periods of stress and duress that you survived and mastered. Small events that may still be of great importance to you. Events from your childhood or the recent past. Self-created challenges you met. Periods when you felt powerful. Glories and victories. Wonderful friendships you maintained and so on. 2. How have these successes shaped your life? How have they affected the way you think of yourself and your capabilities? How have they affected your goals and the things you strive for? 3. What role has pride, that is, feeling proud, being praised, expressing praise for others, played in your life? Did your parents show you that they were proud of you when you were a child? How? How have other people responded to your accomplishments? 4. Did your parents show you that they loved you? How? Was affection readily expressed in your family? If not, what are the effects and implications of this for your marriage? 5. What role does pride in your accomplishments play in your marriage?